Better than me? That's good. And very wonderful to see you all here, and my gratitude to the Buddhist Fellowship, as always, for looking after me and for hosting the Dhamma for us all this evening. So, we've come to talk about renunciation this evening. And one of the I'll just let everyone settle down. One of the conveniences of Buddhism is that we have renunciation as one of the qualities that the Buddha said to develop. Actually, one of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And also the Buddha, as well as giving us that teaching, gave us a handy way of being able to avoid practicing it, because he said that because he set up the Sangha, who is a renunciate community. So for lay people, then it's very easy to say, oh, well, the monks have renounced, and then I can sort of give some dana, and then that's good enough, right? And I've actually heard this argument quite explicitly. You know, even people say this for keeping precepts and things. You know, I don't have to keep precepts because, you know, I give to the monks and then they keep the precepts. Does that sound right? Does that sound like the way that Buddha taught? Not quite. Something sounds a bit fishy there. So renunciation is one of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Who can tell me where it fits into the Noble Eightfold Path? Second factor. Right. Sama sankappa. Yeah. Right thought or right intention. And it is one of the aspects of that is thoughts of renunciation or intention of renunciation. Right? So renunciation has different kinds and different levels. Of course, we all know, like on a simple level, we all know that giving is good, right? And even when we're brought up, you know, we're brought up, it's better to give than it is to receive, right? And I remember being brought up, and my mum would tell us that at birthday times, it's better to give birthday presents than it is to get them. I was like, no, it's not. Getting birthday presents is much better. So giving and sharing is part of not just a Buddhist path, but it's part of life, right? I mean, if you can't give anything, then you're just a very selfish person. No one's going to like you. You know, you have to be able to have this aspect of giving and sharing to be even just a remotely decent human being. So what do we mean when we say that it's also part of the Buddhist path? What is there extra that the Buddha brings that isn't just sort of ordinary, everyday giving? Actually, I was interviewed I was in Sri Lanka a few days ago, and we did a TV interview, and they asked us this question. They said, how do we practice renunciation? And I said, well, to begin with, number one, you give away all of your possessions, give away all your money, your house, say goodbye to your family, and just walk down the road with nothing. I said, that's the first step. And it was very funny because the interviewer couldn't help themselves. They just killed themselves laughing. They thought that was so funny. I'm like, I'm being perfectly serious. Yeah. But of course, if you ask the Sangha, then they know exactly what I mean by that. Because once you've done that and you have actually given away all your money and all your possessions and left behind everything that you had, you realize that the job of renunciation is really just starting. It really is just the beginning stages of renunciation. Yeah? These things are just externals. Actually, we're all going to let go of these things. Yeah? When we die, yeah, all of these things, we're going to give them up. Not only are we going to give them up, we have given them up, right? Countless times in our past lives. We've already given these things up so many times. And so the choice, really, is not do we give these things up or not. The choice is, do we give them up willingly, or are they dragged from us kicking and screaming? Right? My precious. Right? That's the choice that we face. So all of us have something different that's difficult to give up. For me, it was my guitars. I have some beautiful guitars. I had a 1972 original American Fender Telecaster with hand-wound pickups. So nice. Any guitarists out there? You know what I'm talking about. I didn't have any. I was a guitarist. I didn't have any money. That wasn't an issue. By the time I ended up in the monastery, there was precious little. So we normally think of our life as a process of, you know, what are the things we have an ambition, what are the things we're going to get, we're going to achieve, we're going to start a family, we're going to get a job, we're going to make an income, we're going to get a house, a place to stay, an apartment, or we're going to get a car, and all of these kinds of things. And so we normally think of life as being a process of getting things. And that's what our attention is at. And you know, you can see that very easily. Like if you look in magazines or on the internet or whatever, people are always talking about the things that they can get. Right? Well, nice food you can buy, nice clothes you can buy, all of these things that you can have. And one of the things that the Buddha said is that he talked about the three aspects of things. He talked about the asada, the adinava and the nisarana. Sada means the sweet taste of things, right? The gratification of things, right? Why they're nice, why they're pleasant, why we enjoy them. Right? Adinava is the danger of them, the drawback, right? It's the part that we normally try to avoid. And then the nisarana is the escape, it's the letting go. Right? So normally we're just trapped in that aspect of the gratification of things. Normally we want things because we want to get pleasure from them, right? And we identify with that because it's the only kind of pleasure that we've really known. It's not really the only kind of pleasure that we've really known. Perhaps better to say it's the only kind of pleasure that we've really paid attention to. And so we want to get more things, we want to have more things because we think that will make us happy. And we think that the opposite of that, we think that renunciation is giving up those things that make us happy. We think it's giving up those things that give us pleasure. And so in our mind, mentally, it's associated with suffering. And of course, this is what the advertising industry is based on, right? So the whole point of advertising is to convince you that getting more things is associated with pleasure. And so the Buddha asks us to spend some time looking at the danger of things, looking at the drawback. Right? What's the drawback of things? A couple of years ago, I was in Sydney and I was doing a dana at the house of a young Sri Lankan couple. They were a very nice couple, professionals, sort of getting their first home, and they wanted to invite a monk to come and bless the home. And they told me the story that when they had settled on that home and signed the contract with that real estate, then the next day they went into work, and they came back from work, and the husband told the story to the wife. He said, "Oh, you know, when I got to work today, I told my boss that we've now, you know, taken out a mortgage to buy this home, and we've signed the contract." And he said that his boss just laughed and said, "Ha ha ha! Now we've got you." And the wife just looked at him and said, "My boss said exactly the same thing." Now we've got you. Right? That's how they get you. Right? That's how they get you. They convince you that you need all these things. You get into debt to pay for them. You have to convince yourself, right? You have to go to university to study for so many years so that you can learn the skills to be able to get the things, right? And so you can't like then say, "Well, actually, it's not really worth getting anyway," right? Because you spent all that time, right? So you have to invest more time and more effort to get it. And it's just got a whole rolling mess. And we don't take time to step back with them and say, "What's going on here? Is this really how I want to live my life? Am I not capable of something more than this? Am I not capable of questioning the values that have been given to me by the people around me, by the corporations, by the economy, and these kinds of things?" And we start to realize that these things all come with a cost. Okay? If you eat too much, you get sick. If you spend too much money, then you get into debt. Right? If you buy a too fast car, you get speeding tickets. Everything comes with a cost. And one of the problems is that we've become very efficient at hiding the cost of things. Right? Think about the parable or the story about when the Bodhisattva was that led him to go forth when he was in the home, and according to the legend, his father King Suddhodana. Thank you. That was a test. Excellent. His father King Suddhodana said hid all the signs, right, of old age and death from him. That's our life, isn't it? That's what we do today. We hide all those signs of those negative parts of reality. But there's no escaping from it. One day we're going to have to realize that these things are part of it. And so when we enjoy things today and we see all of the benefits of our life, We look at all the suffering that's in the world today. We look at poverty, yeah? Terrible poverty in the world today, inequality. These things are intrinsically linked. Right? The fact that we have so much is not just random. It's not because somehow we deserve so much more. Right? It's because there are systems in place historically which have created certain economic systems and all of those things that have differentiated people, not based on what you're worth or anything like that. One of the things, when I studied economics, one of the things that I learnt was that in the West we have this perception that we have this perception that we're generous because we give aid to developing countries, Right? But he pointed out that from an economic point of view, the reality is that the flow of wealth is massively from developing countries to wealthy countries. Right? And so we're just giving them a tiny bit in return. Right? So that's why there's inequality in the world. And when we think about the environment, I'm sure you all heard the horrifying news the last few days about the whale that died from swallowing plastic bags in the ocean. Yeah? Horrifying. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, right? So much pollution. Yeah? So much destruction of the environment. The ravages that we have wreaked upon our planet through our industrial activity, through our commercial seeking, through our inability to let go. I don't know if you've heard of the problems with deforestation in Russia. Have you heard of those problems? Deforestation in Russia? I know about those problems. I read about it in Dostoevsky, who was writing in the mid-19th century. The destruction of the environment is not something new. It's not something that we invented. It's not something that's just happened in the last 5 years or 10 years. It's been going on for centuries. It's been going on at least since the beginning of the industrial society. And yet we've stood back and we've just let it happen. Why? Because it's convenient. It's convenient to use plastic bags, right? It's convenient to have all of the nice things. And because of that, we've avoided seeing that dark side. We've avoided seeing the cost. But that cost is real. Right? I'm not making any of this up. The cost is real. Right? The fish stocks in the sea are disappearing. The world species are disappearing. People estimate between 50 and 70% of all species will become extinct within the next century. Right? This is the fastest and most dramatic collapse in the world's ecosystem that has ever happened. It's far more quick and dramatic than what happened that killed the dinosaurs. And it's happening right now. And you can all feel it. People have been saying to me, oh, it's so much hotter in Singapore than it used to be. Everywhere that I go, you can see it. And you can see the changes in the climate. This is the cost of our greed. This is the cost of our inability to let go. And you know what the crazy thing is? The crazy thing is, what are people's solutions for this? Right? You have someone like Elon Musk whose plan is to set up a civilization on Mars. Right? The crazy thing is that's thinkable. Right? To say we're going to save ourselves by setting up a colony on Mars is thinkable. But to say we're going to save ourselves by consuming less, by not being so greedy, that's not thinkable. Right? When have you ever heard anyone seriously propose that as a policy? When has any politician ever stood on that platform and said, everybody, we should use less? Yes, that's good. Congratulations. Congratulations to the Dutch. So there are different policies on doing different specific things. My hometown for many years, Bundanoon, was the first town in the world that banned plastic water bottles. So that's pretty good. It's not going to make any difference. Like, I hate to be all pessimistic with you, but it's not going to make any difference. So people are making these kinds of gestures. But it's too little too late. And so we're being faced as a society, we're being faced with that same crisis that we're all faced with individually. Right? That crisis we're faced with individually is the knowledge that, well, one day we're going to die. Sorry. Sorry if you didn't, if that little detail had escaped you. Right? One day we're going to die. Maybe today. Right? Maybe today. Who knows? Yeah? In Sri Lanka, I saw one of the monks, they had their seat, and on the seat it had like day of birth, and they had the birthday, and they had day of death, and they left it blank. Who knows? Yeah? Maybe today. But it's one thing. I mean, for me, you know, as a Dharma practitioner, I've been living for many years with this philosophy and this kind of meditation and this way of looking at the world. And so for me to think, okay, one day I'm going to die, doesn't really worry me, right? I mean, I hope it's not too painful and stuff, right? But, you know, okay, one day you die, it's all right. But the problem is that what we're doing to ourselves through our greed and to our planet, it's not natural. It's not inevitable. It's not part of the cycle of nature or anything like that. It's what we have chosen to do. And we could very easily have chosen to do something else. Could we still? Could we still make a different choice? You think so? I have my doubts. We can slow down the deterioration. I mean, the earth is very, very powerful, like very, very, very resilient, right? So the earth is capable of recovery, and I'm sure the earth will recover sooner or later. But will we? Will we slow down? It seems like we haven't even, it's not even on the agenda, really. It seems to just disappear constantly. Yeah. I don't know what it's like here in Singapore, but in Australia, it's terrible. Our government has just completely undone any kind of meaningful effort to try to do anything about climate change. They really just don't care at all. I know, I've spoken to them, and they just don't care. They don't think it's a problem. You know, one of our ex-prime ministers told, when a group of us was speaking to him, said, 1 meter sea level rise probably isn't going to, you know, it's not going to be too much of a problem for Australia. 1 meter sea level rise. Not going to be too much of a problem for Australia. That's how they think. That's the actual leaders of the country. 1 meter sea, what's it going to do to Singapore? Bye-bye? Yeah? Tens of millions of Bangladeshis will be displaced, but I suppose that's not his problem, so he doesn't really care. But yeah, Singapore's big threat. Just in Colombo, I never realised that how low-lying Colombo is. Yeah, it's all canals and swamps and things, and that's a serious problem. And I asked the people there, "What's the government doing about it?" Nothing. Yeah, it's a huge problem. Why aren't we paying more attention to it? Why aren't we actually trying to? why do we keep electing governments and putting people into power who are doing nothing to try to save the planet? I don't know. I think it's weird. Well, this is true. Yeah. I don't think they think of anything much at all. Yeah. I had this conversation with my stepfather a few years ago. He's passed away now. He was like 80 or something. We were talking about climate change with him and my mother. And he said, "Oh, well, at least I'll be gone before it happens." Thanks a lot. That's just terrific. You'll just come here, ruin the world for us, and then just let us cope with it. Thanks a lot, I said. Well, let me tell you about this little thing called rebirth. Oh, dear. And so this idea of renunciation, to start to ask ourselves, what would it be like if we were to even think about living in a way where our society valued letting go and sharing as much as it did greed and getting more things. I mentioned this the other day and someone said, sounds like communism to me. Maybe. I don't know, we'd like to do without the whole kind of gulag death camp side of things. In Thailand, the past king had a philosophy of economics he called Sedikit Porphing, which means a sufficiency economy. And I don't really know much about the details of it, but it sounds like quite a nice idea, right? The idea that economy should be based on having just enough rather than on having as much as you can possibly have. Of course, he was one of the world's richest men, so put it into perspective. So what would it be like to live in a world where you were at your work and your boss said, oh, we want to give you a raise, and you say, meh, I'm good. Has anyone ever done that? No. Do you think you ever would? Oh, I'm not saying that you should. I mean, you probably I'm sure you all deserve raises. Exactly, yeah, they've got you. So what would it be like to live in that world? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine, isn't it? Because the world is built so much on this idea that of more and more and more. And, you know, actually most human society is not really like that. Most human society tended to be relatively stable, you know, for long periods of time. So it's not that it's impossible to do, and this is one of the things I want to try to convey in this talk, is that this idea of how we live, it's not inevitable, right? It's not foreordained that we have to be like this. We can live differently. When I was at university, I studied philosophy. We talked about it a bit this morning. And I was an extremely bad student. And one of the things I was very bad at was that because I was studying philosophy, I used to read papers in just about every field except for philosophy. So I read quite widely in various other fields, including anthropology at the time. And I became very interested in that for a while. And one of the things that really struck me in anthropology was reading about like the different ways that people lived and different, especially like different tribes and different primitive peoples all over the world who had different kind of ethos and different way of living and how incredibly diverse they were. I mean, seriously, the marriage systems and the ethical systems and economic systems and all of these kinds of things, they had incredible diversity from one tribe to the next. And that's really kind of stuck with me, that idea that human beings are quite capable of living in many, many very different ways. Right? And we can see that in the world around us today. We can see that even though there's a tendency towards everything becoming homogenous and having this kind of homogenous global culture, but still there's so much diversity in how people live when we step outside of that and what their values are. We can choose different values. And there are plenty of people who are choosing different values. And I dare say that many of the people here are choosing different values, right? And typically the people who come to a Dhamma center are not the ones who are, you know, most kind of rah-rah-rah about making lots of money and stuff, right? You're the people who have already realized, okay, it's good, it's all right, get a job, make a living, have a nice place, that's all fine, but there's something more to life, right? And that's why you're here. So somehow we have to learn to imagine a way of living where having things and having more things is not, well, it's not necessarily the most important thing. It's maybe not even possible. And then I come back to this idea that our choice isn't, do we give up this thing? Right? Just like our choice isn't, are we going to give up our life? Our choice is how we give up our life. Right? The same thing with civilization. You look around you, all of the things that we take for granted, electricity, cars, internet, we are going to have to give up those things sooner rather than later. And our choice is not, are we going to keep having this kind of society that we've had? Our choice is going to be, are we going to change with a measure of graciousness? Are we going to step forward into the future with some degree of intelligence, right? Some degree of acceptance? Or are we going to have it grabbed, pulled away from us, kicking and screaming? It's the last polar bear. Here's my, you know, the choice. On my phone, I can either upgrade my phone or I can save the last polar bear. That's what I can do with my last money. So I've got to make that choice, right? But that's what we're doing when we're spending money. When you go shopping and you're buying new clothes and things like that, just remember, you're making that choice. Yeah. So what kind of world would it be like to live in if we lived in a world that was based on renunciation rather than one that's based on greed? Well, of course, the Buddhist Sangha provides us some idea of what that might be. Now, of course, the Buddhist Sangha is not a not an exact model of what a lay community would be like. There's obviously a lot of differences, but I think there are some things that are in common. So what are some of the principles and the values that we use to live as monastics and that help us to be content with having less things? Well, I can only speak for myself here in my own experience, because there's lots of different monks and nuns and they have different experiences. But one of the things that we do is we try to design our lives in a way that will reward or make it amenable for those who want to have less. Okay, just give you some simple examples off the top of my head. If you've ever visited Bodhinyana in Perth, Ajahn Brahm's monastery, I'm sure you all saw the Dhamma Hall and the kangaroos and the Dhana Sala and all of those kinds of things. But did you see the monk's storeroom? Yeah, next time you go there, you should ask if you can see the monk's storeroom. Okay? Storeroom. No, not the kitchen storeroom, the monk's storeroom. Because when Ajahn Brahm built that place, he built a really tiny storeroom. It's basically a cupboard, right? And that's got to keep all of the stores, all the robes, all the medicines, all the everything for all of the monks in the monastery. Yeah? And he did that for a very obvious reason, right? If you've been to many monasteries, you see that because there's this tradition in Theravada where people give things, but they don't necessarily always think about it all that much. You know, generosity is prized a little bit more than wisdom sometimes. And so in the monasteries, there's like these robes stacked to the ceiling, filling up rooms, and the amount of things that you get. And it's always toothbrushes and all of these things, and there's just huge amounts of them. And, you know, robes, we just wear one set of robes, right? And I usually last about 3 years or something. 3 years or 5 years. Like these robes I had before I left Bodhinyana. So what was that? That was three and a half years ago, yeah. So I'm just wearing the same set of robes I had then. And they're still good. All right? So what are we going to do with all those extra robes? Yeah? And so we just sort of pile them up. And so it becomes a kind of a burden on a monastery, right? It becomes this one of those things that really kind of clogs everything down. It becomes hard to clean. It's hard to maintain. What do you do with them? And there's no real good solution to it. Because you want to respect the generosity of the donors, but at the same time... So now what they do in Perth, they recycle them. So they just recycle the robes, so everybody knows. So you still do the ceremony of offering robes, but then they just sort of go around in a circle. So everyone still gets a chance to offer them. But so that works well, you know, because it's something nice about it, right? It's a tradition, so it's nice to keep the tradition. So that's a nice solution to that. But that's an example of the way that we approach the lifestyle in a way that's going to make it easy for us to want little, It makes it hard for us to want lots. Right? So next time, think about that. If you're looking at a flat or somewhere you want to stay in, instead of asking how big the cupboards are, ask how small the cupboards are. Right? Smaller cupboards makes it easy for you to deal with less things. Right? And another thing that is a phenomenon I've seen a number of times is that the people have boxes of stuff that they have kept, like in the basement or the garage or the spare room, from their last house that they haven't unpacked in the new house. Is that right? Yeah, so that's not just an Australian phenomenon, is it? So what do you think of that? What do you think of all of that stuff you've got sitting in that room that you've just brought from your last house that you haven't unpacked yet? Do you think possibly maybe you don't really need it? Yeah? And yet you still go out and buy new stuff. Yeah. So maybe think, okay, the old stuff, give it away. Yeah. And you start to appreciate it, right? You start to appreciate having space. Right? You realize it's a burden. Right? Pay attention to that. Right? If you go home and if you think, okay, finally, we'll get rid of those boxes from that spare room, just pay attention to that. When you give it away, oh, it's so nice to have some space there. And your mind will immediately start thinking what you can fill it with. Maybe you can fill it with space. That's nice. Yeah. Maybe you can have some more empty space in your life. That's not a bad thing. So that's one of the examples. The other thing is, like when we're moving in and out of, because as monks and nuns, right, we don't usually have like our own personal kuti, right? The kuti belongs to the monastery. Okay, so I don't have a place. People ask you, "Where's your base?" I've got nothing. Like literally, I've got nothing. Like people who saw me when they arrived, I have my bag, my monk's bag, and that's it. And my bowl, that's it. That's like literally all the possessions that I have. Right? So if it doesn't fit into my little bag, it doesn't go. And I gave this talk about in Sri Lanka, and I talked about this, and I said, I've mentioned that if people give you gifts when you're a monk and you're traveling. And I said, but I can't take them anywhere because they don't fit in my bag. So I'm going to say the same thing tonight. So if anyone's brought any gifts, that's very kind. But I'll leave them behind. Yeah, I don't take them with me. I don't have any room. I haven't got any room for any more things. So I've just got one bag, and that's got all my things in it. But you know the crazy part? The crazy part is half of those things I don't really need. Half of them I could leave behind, it wouldn't make much difference. Right? And so when as monks or nuns, when we move from a place, like one of the etiquette is that we never leave anything behind. Like it's not an absolute rule. Sometimes you might say, look, I've got some books and I'll leave them behind, or I might have something and I'll give them to one of the monks to take care of and so on. But generally speaking, right, that's the idea, is that when you go, you take everything you have with you and you don't leave anything behind. Right? And so that's very, very clarifying for your mind. You know, what exactly do I have? What matters? What am I going to take with me? And every little thing becomes something you have to concern yourself with. It's not just, you can't just throw it in a cupboard or a drawer and not worry about it, right? You have to actually take it out and look at it and think, well, what am I going to do with this? Am I going to bring it with me to my next place? Am I going to leave it behind? Am I going to give it to someone to care about it? Right, so we actually have to take responsibility for all our possessions. And again, that's very clarifying. Right? So these are some of the things. Another one that's also like a principle that we use a lot is that reflection on the requisites, and the reflection that the requisites have a purpose. And also we have this idea of because they are things which are given to us. And this idea of the sadhadana, like the gift of faith. So all of the things that we have, you know, we never feel like we have a right to them, right? We feel like it's a privilege that somebody has given us something. And, you know, to you, you might think it's just an ugly old brown robe, it doesn't mean anything. But to me, it's something that's very beautiful and it's very precious. So that I think also pertains in the lay life, like when you have things, right? That idea that somehow we deserve to have them, right? You paid money, therefore you deserve it. And remember, this was a kind of a big shift in my thinking when I first went into the monastery. But actually, you know, all of these things that we have, you know, this just comes from the land. Right? This comes from the land and the air and the water. Yeah? It comes from the labor of countless people who've worked hard. Right? Usually worked in very bad conditions, poor conditions, to produce the clothes that we wear, to produce the food that we eat. Yeah? We eat food every day. We complain to the restaurant or whatever if we don't get what we like. Yeah? But making food is really hard. Farming is really hard. Somebody's been down there in the dirt and working hard every day to grow this food. And so to have that attitude that everything that we have is a blessing, everything is something that we should be that's precious and that we should be grateful for. Right? So you should never like complain if you get the food that you don't like or anything like that. You'd be grateful that you have anything to eat at all. And you know, we now have more than 7 billion people on this planet. I mean, and yet, Mother Earth still feeds us all. Yeah, and actually, people talk about like overpopulation, and we're going to be starved because of overpopulation. But really, that's not the problem, right? The problem isn't that there are too many people, right? I saw a documentary not long ago. One of the things they looked at was the shark fishing, and they catch all of these sharks. Like thousands of them or millions of them, and they just cut their fins off and throw the rest of them away. And it's just horrifying. Right? I mean, these beautiful beasts, just their dead bodies, just literally just thrown into the ocean to rot. Why? Because people don't like to eat the rest of it. They just like to eat the fins. They can make money out of that. And that's the reason why these things are going on. Actually, if we were to eat efficiently, we could eat plankton, right? Seaweed, yeah? Yeah, spirulina, all of these kinds of things. There's more than enough. It's actually very easy to produce enough food for all the humans on the earth. But we don't like to eat that. We like to eat steak, yeah? Or tuna or whatever it is. I don't know what people like to eat. Right? That's what's driving it. That's what's driving the destruction of the planet. It's not that we have to. It's that we want. And we can't persuade people to stop having what they want. So why don't we start with ourselves? Why don't we start with saying, let's give up those things that are going to be causing harm to others. Let's give up plastic bags. Yeah. What does Singapore have any policies on plastic bags?
No.
I mean, it's crazy right these days. I mean, living in Taiwan for the last few years, I mean, sometimes it's just absurd. Like, people give you like a box of like biscuits and it's wrapped in plastic, and then inside there's like a plastic tray with each biscuit in a plastic thing, and then each biscuit is wrapped in its own plastic thing. I mean, seriously? And then they'll like peel bananas and wrap them in plastic. Have you seen that? That's another excellent one. Crazy. And all the things that are so unnecessary. So why not make a start, right? Stop using plastic bags, right? And you know, make your choices known, right? When you're buying things and things like that, then just tell the people at the supermarket or the shops or whatever, say, you know, we should just tell them, I don't want to use your plastic bags. Do you have a non-plastic bag? Yeah? And when people will hear this, people running shops will hear this, right? There's no other way this is going to happen. It's not going to happen just spontaneously. It'll only happen when people start to make those choices. Right? Plastic water bottles. Terrible. Each plastic water bottle, like, you know, if a water bottle is this big, a third of that is oil. Right? That's how much oil it takes to produce a plastic water bottle. Yeah? Terrible. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah, I know. It's bad, isn't it? Yeah. So we try to do what we can to reduce as much of these things as we possibly can. You know, we're told sometimes we should recycle. But recycling is good. We should recycle, but recycle is a very poor substitute for actually just reducing things. Right? Recycling things is very hard. It's very expensive. It takes a lot of energy, and it's not very efficient. And a lot of the time, stuff doesn't actually get recycled anyway. Again, I'm not sure what happens in Singapore, but we just had a big scandal in Australia because we used to ship all of our recycling from Sydney off to China, and then they're like, "No, we don't want it anymore." And it turns out no one really had any idea what they were doing with it when it got to China anyway. So now Australia's like, what are we going to do? They don't have the facilities. So it's much better if you can just not produce the stuff in the first place. Yeah. So always just think about these things. And the thing is that there's so many of these things. It's nothing unusual. It's just what our mums and dads used to do. Right? It's not that this is the way that humanity has always been, right? I remember when we went shopping, we would just use the cardboard boxes from the supermarket, you know. And I remember my grandmother saying to me, and this must have been maybe about 1980s, maybe 82 or something like that, and I was just a teenager and I was just starting to shave and I had a disposable razor and she looked at it and she said, "Oh, I don't like them. Such a waste." Right? And just that difference, you know, to think that to us a disposable razor is nothing, right? I mean, in the scheme of things, that's just such a small thing, right? But actually it's true, isn't it? It's just a waste. It's a waste. In the old days you'd have a blade, you'd sharpen it, and you keep one blade for many years. It's a bit more convenient to have a disposable razor. And that's what we've traded our planet for. A bit more convenience. Yeah. So we need to start thinking about, changing some choices that we're making. Yeah? Thinking about living a life that's attuned to having little. Instead of thinking, it couldn't hurt to have one more, then think to yourself, it couldn't hurt to have one less. Yeah. So I don't know what our future holds. I, as you may have guessed from this talk, I'm not particularly optimistic. Frankly, I think we're doomed, actually. And one of the reasons that I talk about these things is because I think a lot of people share these kinds of feelings and a lot of people have these kinds of worries, but it's very difficult to articulate it. Right? It's very difficult to talk about it in public because you feel a bit crazy. I feel a bit crazy sometimes. Well, a lot of the time. But these are the realities that we're living with. And so if we're Dhamma practitioners, we should be prepared to face, what are these realities? Right? So this is what we have. This is the asada of our industrial, very sort of successful economically culture, is that we have all of these material comforts and we have all of these things which, you know, make our life much more pleasant and much easier. But they also have the ardinava, and the ardinava, the atmosphere, CO2, the oxygen, the plastic in the oceans, collapse of the ice sheets, all of those things. This is the ardinava. This is the cost of our lifestyle. Right? And then the nisarana is the escape. That gentleman's just found the escape. It's very symbolic, right? He's not just walking out of the room. He's leaving samsara. That's the symbol. So the escape is through letting go. Right? We don't have to begin with big gestures. We can begin with very small things. Right? What's important about letting go, it's not how dramatic the gesture of letting go is. Right? It's about how much of a habit it becomes, how much of a custom it becomes. It should become just like a normal way that you think about everything. Right? To think about things as being burdens, think about nothing, being freeing. Yeah? And you know, after so many years of cultivating and being a monk, you know, there's nothing more free for me than just that feeling of just having nothing. Having just being able to walk down the road and not have any burdens, not have any expectations, and just have that feeling of freedom. It's so light and so wonderful. So I would encourage you to try to question what can we moderate, what can we have less of, to try to cultivate the kinds of happiness and pleasure that come with the freedom from those things. Yeah? And to start to think about and to imagine what kind of world might we create if we were to create a world that wasn't built upon greed. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I offer that for your reflection. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Ajahn. Just a small comment before I ask the question.
No comment. Only question. No,
there was this talk of talking about death, and everybody was knocking their head. But there was one lady there who was shaking their head. So the speaker asked the lady, why do you shake your head? Oh, I'm not worried, because by the time my turn comes, they would have invented an immortality pill, so I'm not worried at all. So that's
really?
That's the thing. So my question is that among different traditions of Buddhism, and even in Theravadin, they are allowed to have to receive money. They are allowed to work. The Tibetan Buddhists are allowed to work. So how do you reconcile that with renunciation?
All right. Okay. Well, first of all, on immortality pills. They can't cure the common cold. I mean, come on. These things are crazy, right? No, they're not going to cure immortality. It's not going to happen. I can confidently predict that. It's human hubris, you know? It's like Google had an immortality project, you know? So like Google, like they built a very nice search engine and a good email client and a good web browser. Next, we're going to cure death. Yeah, there's a kind of a big leap between being a good programmer and curing death. So no, there's not going to be any immortality pills, and no, you're not going to be able to freeze yourself and come back to birth in some in the future or any of those kinds of things. So using money, money shmoney, right? I mean, depends on what you're using it for and how you're doing it. Right? I mean, I know a lot of in Australia, a lot of Tibetan monastics who are like desperately poor and have no place to live, and no, they find it scraping by to find food to eat and just to get the necessities of life, and they don't get any offerings from the lay community, and there's the only way they can survive is to get a part-time job, and so they drive a taxi or they do some kind of work to get a few bucks so that they can survive, and they have to pay money to stay at their Dharma center. So what can you say? I don't blame them. Yeah, I feel sorry for them, you know. And then in Theravada, we're so lucky, you know, people are so generous and we have so much, you know. I mean, like I was talking before, like, you know, I don't have anything. I don't use money. I don't have any possessions. At the same time, though, I can do anything I want. Like, you know, I just flew from Colombo to here and I'm going to fly to Perth. I can fly wherever I want. Right? It's easy. I just have to say, oh, it'd be nice to go to San Francisco next week. And then someone would come along and say, oh, please, Bhante, can I offer you a ticket? Yeah, because people are so generous. And, you know, it's our responsibility to use that wisely, right? Like, I wouldn't really go to, you know, to America to go to Disneyland. not primarily anyway, right? So it's our responsibility to use that wisely, right? But I'm a priest. You know, I noticed this once when I was in Thailand, like in the forest tradition. See, forest tradition also is a very renunciate tradition. But one of the paradoxes in Buddhism is basically that the more renunciate the tradition is, the more wealthy it is. Right? So in Thailand, like you'd have a forest monastery, where, and at the Katina time, they might be given like 10 million baht for the katina, and meanwhile the village monastery might get 10,000-20,000 baht. Right? And but they use money in the village monastery. Right? Why do they use money? Well, partly because they don't have lots of rich lay people with bank accounts who can pay for them to do stuff. You know, I was in India some time ago, and I could tell you many stories like this. Oh, the story was India, and I was teaching a group of nuns, bhikkhunis and seminaries there, who were Indians, mostly from Maharashtra, and most of them were Dalits. And they were nothing, absolutely dirt poor, and had never got any support during their whole time. And many of them, they told us these heartbreaking stories, you know, like they'd been in robes for 20 years or something, 10 years or 20 years. And they said to us, nobody has ever taught us before. They said, we've never read any Dhamma books apart from the Dhammapada and books by a book by Ambedkar. That's the only Dhamma they'd ever had access to, right? No one had ever taken the time to teach them or to ask them their story or to ask them if they needed anything. Yeah? And so then from there, I was invited to, again, being a Western monk, I'm very privileged. So I was invited to the big hotel there, the fancy hotel where the president just stayed. Can't remember what it was. And, you know, it's a big five-star restaurant, five-star hotel in near Bodh Gaya. And there was a bunch of forest monks from Thailand staying, right? With all their beautiful, wealthy lay devotees inviting them everywhere and offering them things all the time and looking after them. But sure, they weren't handling money, right? So again, I'm not meaning to criticize anyone. This is the world we live in, right? But I'm just saying that it's not so simple as saying, do people use money or not use money, right? So yes, we are supposed to live a renunciate lifestyle, and part of that renunciate lifestyle should be to give up money. But I personally feel much more. I feel much more of a connection as a brother or sister with a monastic who has nothing and who has to work to pay the bills and to get by, than with a monastic who perhaps on the surface of it doesn't use money but runs a multi-million dollar temple and, you know, has all of this wealth and so on in there. And so this I think is the important thing, is to look at what is people's motivations and actually how they're living. Yeah.
Hi, Ajahn. I have a very practical question.
Okay.
As a woman, if you try to reduce what you have to the very basic minimum,
right,
and you get an invitation to a nice wedding dinner, and you have nothing to wear, no clothes, no shoes,
no
bags.
I know, right? I know.
So how do you suggest we solve this problem?
Right? Right? No, very true, and thank you for that. And you should do like a weekend workshop or something like that, right? Renunciation for women. This happened to us when we were just in Colombo, actually, and I went there with, you know, we noticed that because actually that's right. So the week that we were there, one of the difficulties that we ran in was that there was lots of traffic jams everywhere, right? And one of the reasons we realized that the traffic was even worse than normal was because everyone was having weddings, right? Why were they having weddings? Because, of course, the royal wedding, right? So everyone booked their wedding date to be on the same date as the royal wedding, right? So anyway, so there's all this kind of things. And you know, you see the wedding couples posing for photos, right? And it's kind of crazy, you know, see the brides all sort of dolled up in all of these things and hairdo and henna and all of these things. And the guy's just like in a suit or just with a simple thing. And they're like, oh, I just had to slap on a shirt and a pair of trousers and then you can go and stand there. And she's been there for hours getting things ready. It's just not fair. And one of the ladies who organized my trip there, Sri Lankan lady from Sydney called Deepika, and she was invited to a wedding in a thing, and she faced exactly that problem because she'd packed minimally. She didn't have any fancy shoes or anything like that, and yet she had to go to a wedding. So, yes, she faced exactly that problem. How did she solve it? Well, she just asked around and borrowed some. So she had to try to do the best that she could. Yeah. Yeah, but it's a good thought. Maybe you could do that. Maybe it could be like a service that the BF could provide. Right? Right?
Exchange.
I'm not kidding.
Thoughts.
No, I'm serious. That you, all of your fancy gowns and shoes and jewellery and things, you can give them up, give them to the BF. You keep them in a closet here. Right? And then when you've got to go to a wedding or something, then you can come and borrow it. I think that's a great idea.
That's what happened to me. I didn't know that my nephew's wedding was supposed to be on 2 days, and so I only bought minimal, only one dress.
Right.
You know, I was like, oh no, it's 2 days. It's not like morning followed by evening, or we can just wear the same one. Oh no, it's okay. It's 2 days. You can just wear the same dress. I said, so what did I end up doing? Borrowed.
Yeah, borrowing. You know, in Australia, they had one of the TV presenters wanted to show up this kind of hypocrisy, because they sometimes on TV shows, like if you have the TV presenter's a woman and she wears the same blouse twice a week, then people write in and complain, how can she wear the same blouse twice a week? So the male TV presenter wore the same suit every day for a year. Nobody noticed. But no, that's a really good question, because that's really practical. And these are the kinds of things that we can think about. I really think that's a great idea, actually. I reckon you should do that. Anyway, go on. Next question.
Does somebody offer their wardrobe? Not at BF.
Ajahn, thank you for your sharing today. You spoke of renouncing things external to us. I'm just curious about your opinions on renouncing on sensual desires, because I find it quite an attachment, and it's like sometimes I know that, you know, it will affect my meditation, but I will still go and do it. And I mean, what is your advice for renouncing main bouts of the sensual desires? Yeah. Within the lay life.
In the lay life. Well, I guess the first thing to do is to say, well, look, what's actually causing harm, right? And so when you're talking about sensual desires, I think you're talking about sexuality. Is that right? Specifically or not? Included but not specifically? Not specifically. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the thing to do is first of all, moderation. And first of all, like in the suttas, they have this concept of visamalobha. So visamalobha is means excessive or unbalanced greed. All right? So this is a kind of greed which is a kind of a normal greed, right? You're hungry and you feel greedy for something to eat. It's a kind of normal greed, right? It actually is perfectly understandable, right? But then there's the unbalanced greed or corrupt greed or excessive greed. So the first thing to do is to look at, well, what's creating harm? And, you know, you're right, I've talked a lot this evening about things that create harm externally. But also, of course, things create harm internally, through addiction or through overindulgence or, you know, whatever it might be. So that's the first thing, is to think, well, what are those things that are actually causing problems? And then say, okay, well, maybe I can start to give those things up. Yeah. And what you find is that that when you start to practice it, when you start to make a habit of it, that it gets easier. Right? So it's good to do something that's clear and very simple and it's very focused. Okay? So I'll just give you one example. When I was a young monk, I some of you may know I like drinking coffee. So, and when you're a monk, you've really got nothing to do all day. Right? Now, in the monastery that I was at, we would have one meal a day in the morning, and then you'd have a chance to have a cup of tea and coffee in the afternoon, right? So that means that basically, after the meal, you've got like 8 hours to think about your next cup of coffee. And, you know, after a while, you kind of realize, oh, yeah, this is attachment. This is ridiculous. What am I doing? I didn't become a monk to just, you know, obsess about these things. And so I just made a determination. I said, not going to have any coffee, not going to have any tea or anything like that, or in the afternoon drinks. And so I won't do that until my fifth Rains retreat. So that was about 3 years or something. So that's what I did. And then at the end of it, after my fifth Rains retreat at Bodhinyana, the monks made me a really strong cup of coffee. I was so buzzed. Oh. So, but just to recognize, you know, it's not like doing something because you think you should be doing something, or giving something up because you see somebody else is doing it, or because, you know, you think that you should do it. But you just look at what is actually creating harm, right? What's actually something that's too much for you, or is too excessive, or something like that. And also those things that are associated, you know, especially the things that are associated with, say if we look at goods or things like buying things, you know, we know that we can buy like fair trade coffee and these kinds of things. So we look specifically those things that are causing harm to others, but also those things that are causing harm to people around us, like in relationships and these kinds of things, right? And so, you know, often if we're overindulged, whether it be in sexuality or in food or drugs or anything like that, then it can cause a lot of harm to the people around us. Yeah? And so moderation is always good. Right? So if things are not causing too much of a problem, then don't make too much of a problem out of it. All right? So don't come with too much of an idealized perspective that, oh, yes, I should be giving up everything. Right? It's okay. Right? It's okay to have things in moderation and to enjoy life. Right? So the Buddha never said that you shouldn't do that. Right? But just when you start to notice things are getting out of balance, that's when you start to practice letting go. Okay. Ah. Yes, that's a big one, isn't it? Yeah. Addiction to how many people here are addicted to their handphones? How many people are lying? Right? I don't know. Before I went to do my retreat to translate suttas, I had a phone, and then I always expected to get a new one when I came out of retreat. But then by the time I came out of retreat, I actually got much more disillusioned with technology and all of these kinds of things, and I was like, oh, I don't really want one anymore. So everyone's been telling me, oh, you need a phone. I'm like, why? And so far no one's given me a good reason, so it's okay. I've more and more come to be convinced, because, you know, I do web development, right? I'm not a Luddite, and I sort of run a very sophisticated Buddhist text website, and we're talking with programmers and dealing with programmers every day. And so I think that technology certainly has a positive use, but I've more and more come to believe that a computer is something that that sits in a place, and you should walk over to it and use it, and then switch it off when you finish using it. I know it sounds like a radical idea. Yeah? So that you remain in control of it. It's not something that's going to follow you around all day. And what we have in a smartphone is more computing power than we took to send a man to the moon. Right? And which raises the question, like, with that computing power, they sent a man to the moon. What do we do with it? Right. So, you know, these days I would certainly, honestly, I would strongly recommend deleting Facebook. You should all delete Facebook. It's horrifying. Yeah. And then Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat can follow along behind. Right? And then you can start to think about, is there any point in having a smartphone anymore? Yeah. But definitely it's something that, that you should take a break from and that you should make sure that you limit your usage of. Yeah. Especially with kids. Yeah. A few years ago in Switzerland, they did a survey and they asked the kids what's the biggest complaint about the parents, and the number one complaint was that they spend too much time using their smartphones. Yeah. Interesting. Okay, next question. All right.
The way you fish your talk is that the more we can announce, renounce, the better it is. That's how you pitch your...
Right.
The more we can announce in this world, the better it is. But the problem is that once we announce more, then we have this notion, I announce more than you. So how do you avoid the trap? And also how do you prevent others from falling into this kind of trap?
Well, okay, so the question was, if you renounce, then you can get into competitive renunciation. You could do like a game show or something like that. Well, it's better than being competitive about something really stupid. Right? I've got a bigger car than you. I've got a bigger house. I'd much better to be competitive about how much you can give up. I think it's all right. I mean, it's not ideal, you know. But the giving up is giving up, right? And see, this is the thing, is that when you get more, right, it promotes that attitude of wanting and getting and comparing and having and that whole attitude. Yeah. But when you're giving up, the very nature of it is that you're giving up that sense of self. Right? So yes, it's still there, and yes, those things will still come up, right? But the act of giving itself is wearing that away. So it's not something you really have to worry about. Just if you notice it, and you notice that sense of conceit or pride coming up, just say, oh, okay, it's natural, just let go of it. It will solve itself. Yeah. Okay. So maybe we're about time we should wrap up. What do you think? Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. That sounds good. So now you're going to do the sharing of merits? Please, I invite you to do the sharing of merits.
Okay, let's do.
Tavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Tavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etta vata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Idang me nyatinang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang me nyatinang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang me nyatinang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let's pay respect to Buddha. And to Ajahn. Thank you, Ajahn. May I check whether is Henry Yeo here yet? Oh, yes. Maybe Ajahn, you would like to get to your room while I make announcements? Okay.